false flags, active measures, disinformation, and subversion campaigns. This week, one of the things that we've been hit with again is sarin gas attack again in Syria. And we're meant to believe that this is real and that a man who's a medical doctor trained in England is so stupid that he would actually unleash sarin gas at the very time when the Americans are withdrawing and when he's winning the war. And every time he's winning the war, something like this happens. It's happened three times now that they suddenly blame sarin gas attacks on the Syrian government fighting the ISIS terrorists and others, and the allies want to come back in. So before we even tackle that, let's get a bit of the history of it. Jeremiah 9 verse 5 says, "Everyone will deceive his neighbor and will not speak the truth. They have taught their tongues to speak lies. They weary themselves to commit iniquity." Is that not true for today? The term false flag originally referred to the pirates who flew flags of countries as a disguise to dissuade their victims from fleeing or preparing for battle. And sometimes the flag of another country is used in order to blame an attack incorrectly on a targeted country. Today, false flag has extended way past naval encounters to include countries and organizations that organize attacks on themselves and make the attacks appear to be made by their opponents. Like every time swastikas are painted on a synagogue or on Jewish graves, it turns out that the local rabbi did it. And it's just extraordinary how many times you get Muslim mosques are desecrated, and it turns out in the end actually the Muslims organize themselves in order to get sympathy. So this has gone way past countries now. In this way, false flag operations seek to give governments the desired pretext for either domestic repression or foreign military aggression. Covert government agencies frequently use civilian organizations to carry out operations which serve government interests. They've had all sorts of, I think there was Air America, which did a huge amount of drug dealing and smuggling in Indochina, Cambodia and Laos and so on, and it was a CIA op. And there's many things like that. Now, I know of major operations which were run by the military, but it looked totally civilian. So the definition, here's the definition of a false flag. False flag operations are covert operations conducted by governments, corporations or other organizations which are designed to appear as if they are being carried out by other entities. The name is derived from the military concept of flying false colors, that is, flying the flag of a country other than your own. False flag operations are not limited to war and counterinsurgency operations. They have been used in peacetime, for example, during Italy's strategy of tension, which we'll deal with just now. Basically, we're talking about fraud and dishonesty in all kinds of ways. All governments lie. How can you tell that a politician is lying? His lips move. Yeah. And even when they die, they lie still. So if we lie to the government, it's a crime. But if the government lies to us, it's just politics. Although forbidden by the Geneva Convention and by the Hague Rule of Warfare, false flag operations are pervasive. So the Geneva Convention in Article 37 prohibits the feigning of an intent to negotiate under a flag of truce or of surrender, or feigning of an incapacitation by wounds or sickness, or the feigning of civilian non-combatant status, or the feigning of a protected status, like wearing Red Cross medic armband or something like that, or of the use of signs, emblems, uniforms of the United Nations, or of a neutral or other state, or of those who are not parties to the conflict. Under Article 38, it is prohibited to make improper use of the distinctive emblem of the Red Cross. That is sacrosanct. You don't abuse the Red Cross symbol. They are not to be fired on, and you can't, for military purposes, use that as a disguise. Article 39 forbids the use of flags, emblems, insignia, or uniforms of neutral or other states not party to the conflict. So that's pretty clear. You shall not steal, nor deal falsely, nor lie with one another. We read in Leviticus 19:11. But there are many documented cases, and tonight we're going to talk about documented cases of false flag attacks in history where government has carried out, for political purposes, a terror attack on their own people, and then falsely blamed its targeted enemy. Now, I don't know about you, But I think when I was the age of some of you, I would not have believed that any of our governments in the West could ever carry out a terrorist attack on their own people. I wouldn't have believed it because, you know, we're the good guys. We don't do that sort of thing. But sadly, we've got too many examples of this being done by now. Romans 3:13, with their tongues they have practiced deceit. The poison of asps is under their lips. First major false flag operation in history, the Great Fire of Rome, which is the setting of the Apostle Paul film that's just come out now. AD 64, 19th of July, two-thirds of the city of Rome was burned down in a huge fire. Senior Roman leaders, including the Roman consul Cassius Dio and the historian Suetonius, confirmed that the Emperor Nero sent out arsonists to start the fire because the Roman Senate had just rejected Nero's application to clear 300 acres in central Rome so that he could build his extravagant palace complex, bigger than it already was. Nero then falsely blamed the Christians for starting the fire, and this justified rounding up, brutally torturing, murdering many hundreds of Christians, including the apostles Peter and Paul. And Nero famously played his harp while Rome burned. And there's a lot of examples in art of this, of the Great Fire of Rome. And Christians were literally lit up as Roman torches, set alight to entertain Nero, and Christians were taken at the arena and fed to wild beasts. The truthful lip shall be established forever, but a lying tongue is but for a moment. In 1898, the highly suspicious explosion which sank the USS Maine warship in Havana Harbor in Cuba killed over 260 American seamen and sparked the Spanish-American War, which had as its slogan, "Remember the Maine, wage war on Spain," or, as another put it, "Remember the Maine, to hell with Spain." Here's the Maine heading into Havana Harbor. For some strange reason, when America wanted a war with Spain, they decided on a goodwill visit of their battleship into Havana. And while it was there, it suddenly blew up, killing 260 seamen. And the Americans were ready immediately. As the ship was blown up, the U.S. battle fleet was as far away as Philippines. Now, if you look on the map, the Philippines are a long way away, and immediately destroyed the Spanish fleet in the Pacific, seized the whole of the Philippines before they even started with Cuba. And a huge New York Journal and Times, there was a competition between Rudolf Hearst and Pulitzer. These are two main newspaper magnates, and they were both egging one another on and who could be more extreme than the other. And one time Hearst actually published a newspaper headline, "How do you like our war?" And he's using the name of his newspaper's war because they had, he said, you know, "We've started this war." He sent a journalist down to Havana to cover the war, and the journalist cabled back saying, "There's no war here." He said, "You stay there and you provide the pictures, I'll provide the war." And it's now proven, when they went through it and checked it out, it was, of course, immediately blamed on a Spanish mine or torpedo that the Spanish had blown up ship. But when they raised the ship and checked it all out, it was quite clear that it hadn't blown up from any external reason. It was internal, and they couldn't go as far as saying, "We did it to our own ship." I mean, it killed 260 American seamen. The whole war, which destroyed the Spanish Empire, seized vast amount of property. The U.S. used the blowing up of the main ship to destroy the Spanish fleet, and Spain was considered a world power at that time, and America was not. This was the marking entrance of America to being a world power. They seized a lot of territory like Guam Island, Wake Island, the Philippines, and Cuba. You may wonder, what was General Douglas MacArthur doing in the Philippines? I mean, the Philippines are a long way away from America at the beginning of the Second World War. Why were the American troops abandoned on Corregidor? How come we had Wake Island? What were we doing on Midway? And how do we end up with a base in Guantanamo Bay in Cuba? Well, answer is 1898. Remember the Maine, to hell with Spain, wage war in Spain. And they were ready. The incredible thing is that Spain didn't see this coming. And when this war broke, the U.S. Navy was already pre-positioned to take the Philippines, pre-positioned to take all these different islands, and the U.S. Navy was brand spanking new, whereas the Spanish Navy was kind of old, because they were more established. So they had a tremendous advantage. And, of course, they knew what they were doing. Here's the battle of Manila Bay, which is the capital of the Philippines. You can see the Spanish flags, the Spanish fort getting totally pounded by the U.S. Navy. And this all because apparently Spain blew up the USS Maine, which no American historians believe that Spain had anything to do with it. It was either an accident or, more likely, it was a totally planned false flag operation. So here you get in a homeschool textbook, location. Where's Cuba located in relation to the United States? Location. In the war, the United States launched its first attack against the Philippine Islands. Why might this have surprised the Spanish? Well, no jokes. I mean, look at your map. You've got to turn your globe all the way around to find the Philippine Islands. It's south of China. It's a long way from the United States. This would have surprised the Spanish. Like, something's happened in Havana, and next thing, whoa, we're being attacked in the Philippines, and the entire Pacific fleet of the Spanish has gone down to Davy Jones' locker, as they would have said. This, of course, marks the entrance of the United States as a major world power, sea power, and an imperial power. Not that any American would want to admit that they were an empire. It's a strange thing that in the 20th century, the two greatest empires of the world, Russia and the United States, are both in denial that they ever were an empire. Now, France was an empire, Austria was an empire, Spain was an empire, Britain had an empire, but America was never an empire. Then how come you cover so many time zones and have military bases all over the world and so on? And the Russians also, they claim the anti-imperialist, but huh? Then how come your troops are like everywhere? Psalm 101 verse 7 says, "He who works deceit shall not dwell in my house. He who tells lies shall not continue in my presence." And that includes a lot of journalists who were involved in fomenting this war. Many people called it the Yellow War. And by yellow, they're not meaning the Chinese had anything to do with it. They mean the press was a bit of, it's yellow tabloids. The paper tend to be more yellow. It wasn't white paper like we can print now. The paper tend to be a bit more yellowish, the kind of paper they had then. Another documented false flag operation, 18th of September 1931, Japanese troops set off a small, very small, explosion of a train track. It didn't even damage the train track. And blamed it on China in order to justify the invasion of Manchuria. This is known as the Mukden incident or the Manchurian incident, depending if people can pronounce Mukden or not. This marked the beginning. Some people say this is really the beginning of the Second World War, which would make it starting in 1931. But the Imperial Japanese Army moved from Korea into Manchuria and with great brutality and efficiency defeated the Chinese, and they set up a client state called Manchukuo in what would be Manchuria. And there's the Mukden, where the Mukden incident happened, not too far from Beijing. And it wasn't very long before they were invading the whole of China as well. Although, to be fair, they were fighting against communism, which was building up in China, which was a threat to Korea, which would have been a threat to Japan. But if you go to Mukden today, the Chinese government has made a big monument of this 18 of September 1931, remembering this Mukden incident, because that's really where the communists managed to, okay, they were getting hammered, but ultimately it got the US in on their side to destroy Japan to enable the communists to take over China. So communists look at this false flag operation as very important. One of the classic false flags, in a sense, Sunday morning, 7th of December, 1941, the Japanese launched a surprise attack on the US fleet at Pearl Harbor, destroying the Pacific Fleet, forcing the United States into World War II. Well, that's what we were taught at school. But except for the date, 7 December, just about everything about that narrative is actually a myth. The attack was not a surprise. The Pacific Fleet was actually far from destroyed because the aircraft carriers were conveniently absent. Actually, the United States government had done everything possible to bring about the attack. The U.S. ambassador to Japan, Joseph Grew, on 27 January 1941, that's a long time before the attack, wired Washington that Japan was preparing a surprise attack on the U.S. fleet at Pearl Harbor. And when you've got 11 months warning, that's hardly a surprise. 24th of September 1941, a dispatch from Japanese naval intelligence to Japan's consul general in Honolulu, Hawaii, was deciphered. The transmission was a request for the grid of the exact locations of the U.S. naval ships in Pearl Harbor. Yet Washington chose not to share this information with the officers responsible for security at Pearl Harbor. Instead, they got court-martialed afterwards for not doing enough to prevent it, whereas they were deliberately set up. On 26 November, the main body of the Japanese strike force, consisting of 6 aircraft carriers, 2 battleships, 3 cruisers, 9 destroyers, 8 tankers, 23 submarines, 5 midget submarines, all departed secretly from Japan for Hawaii, and nobody knew about it. Despite the myth of strict radio silence, haven't you heard that one? U.S. naval intelligence intercepted many dispatches. They recorded 1,000 radio transmissions to the attack fleet in that 2 weeks. That's not radio silence. And they were all deciphered because the U.S. had broken purple, the code for Japanese naval, back in the 1920s already, which is why they had to invent fax machines to be able to get Japanese script over to the people who were deciphering them on the other side of the Pacific Ocean. Fax machines were specifically an American naval invention to handle Japanese script because telex couldn't handle it, of course. The dispatches left no doubt Pearl Harbor was the target. Even on the night before the attack, U.S. naval intelligence decoded a message pointing to Sunday morning, 7 December, as the deadline for the attack. This message was delivered to military high command in Washington, D.C. more than 4 hours before the attack on Pearl Harbor commenced. However, this information was still withheld from the commanders at Pearl Harbor. Both the Army and naval commanders were denied this info. So having failed to provoke Germany to declare war on America by already selling over $50 billion in war supplies to Great Britain, the Soviet Union, France and China, before the war even began from America's perspective, FDR switched focus to Japan. He couldn't provoke Germany to declare war, so maybe he could provoke Japan. On the 7th of October 1940, one of Roosevelt's military advisors, Lieutenant Commander Arthur McCollum, detailed an 8-step plan to provoke Japan into attacking the United States. This was sealed for 60 years, but it's now declassified and we now have it. Over the next year, FDR implemented all 8 of the recommended provocative actions, including complete oil embargo, rubber embargo and all the rest, effective total economic warfare against Japan, which was guaranteed to Japan would have to fight. There's no way that they could avoid it. And this was the intention. America had effectively declared economic war on Japan, and everyone knew that, and so they were expecting an attack. This has been documented. In Pearl Harbor, the story of the secret war, Pearl Harbor, secret war by George Morgenstern, Pearl Harbor, FDR leads a nation to war by Stephen Gillen, 1941, fighting the shadow war, a divided America and a world at war by Mark Mothram. Operation Snow, how a Soviet mole in FDR's White House triggered Pearl Harbor, by John Costa. Sunday in Hell, Pearl Harbor Minute by Minute by Bill McWilliams. The Truth About Pearl Harbor by John Flynn. And then Kimmel, Short and Pearl Harbor, the final report revealed. Kimmel and Short. Kimmel was the admiral in charge of the Navy. Short was the military commander. And they were both court-martialed for not doing enough to protect it, whereas they were completely set up. They were there to take the fall, basically. And then by Dr. John Coleman, Pearl Harbor and Beyond, an account of treachery and treason, which I think is the correct word. Pearl Harbor Betrayed by Michael Gannon, the true story of a man and nation under attack. And in Pearl Harbor, the mother of all conspiracies by Mark Emerson Wiley. It is the mother of all conspiracies. In one sense, it's not a false flag because the Japanese did the attack. The Japanese had their correct colors and so on. But it's a deception operation in that the Japanese were trapped and cornered and provoked to doing it to fulfill the international ambitions of FDR and Joseph Stalin. And this was an integral part to convince the bulk of Americans, more than 80% of which were against getting involved in Europe's war, to trick them into the war by making them believe we've been attacked in an unprovoked manner without any warning and so on and so forth. Zechariah 8 verse 16, these are the things you should do. Speak each man the truth to his neighbor. Give judgment in your gates for truth, justice, and peace. The Soviet leader, Nikita Khrushchev, admitted that the Soviet Union's Red Army shelled the Russian village of Manila in 1939 in order to blame the attack on Finland as a pretext for launching the Winter War against Finland in 1940. And that was a brutal war, which gave us the Molotov cocktail. The Finns surprised everybody by defeating the Russians, which nobody thought was possible. Can anyone identify this picture? Where is this location? Most people cannot. This is Helsinki's Parliament buildings burning from bombing in 1940 by the Red Army or Red Air Force, should we say. And so here the Finns were under total attack, and most people don't even know about the Winter War. Well, they don't have any idea of the scale of it. Russian President Boris Yeltsin later confirmed that Russia had been the aggressor in the Winter War and that the shelling of Malolo was a false flag operation. So the Russians shelled their own village, killing their own people to justify invading Finland. Then there's the Katyn massacres, which was the subject of last week's presentation. Russian leaders Boris Yeltsin and Vladimir Putin have in recent years admitted that Soviet dictator Joseph Stalin indeed did order the NKVD secret police to execute over 22,000 Polish officers and civilians in 1940 and falsely blame it on the Germans. Classic false flag operation. And strongly recommend the Katyn film, which we've been able to make copies of. So if people want to see this film, which is a major award-winning, probably the most important film ever produced in Poland, and one that most people don't even know exists. Let the lying lips be put to silence, which speak insolent things proudly and contemptuously against the righteous. Active measures was a Soviet term for the actions of political warfare conducted by the Soviet security services. That's the Cheka, who morphed into the NKVD, who morphed into the KGB, to influence the course of world events. Active measures. Now, of course, they also collected intelligence and they produced politically correct assessment of intelligence. But active measures includes media manipulations through disinformation, propaganda, counterfeiting official documents, infiltrating churches, intimidating dissidents, character assassinations, fines, imprisonments, and assassinations. That's all active measures. Active measures included the establishment and support of international front organizations such as the World Peace Council, setting up terrorist groups, or wars of national liberation, especially helped through their stooge and surrogate Fidel Castro, who helped Agostino Neto, the dictator of Angola, for example, infiltrating the World Council churches. Well, they've gone way past that now, they control it. Educational institutions, some close by, where education has been turned into indoctrination. The entertainment industries, in fact, the Soviet KGB Cheka, they targeted already in 1920. They identified Hollywood as key for infiltration. In fact, Stalin was super excited about the cinemas, and he said, we must make the cinemas the alternatives to the church. And in fact, as has been documented by Ted Baer, for many, many years, the Communist Party was the only party in town. I mean, they're the only party in Hollywood, and they infiltrate Hollywood from the very, very beginning. And, yep, they're kind of like sucking many people's brains out. And the news media, Sly Magazine, the Bolshevik Broadcasting Corporation, Useless News and World Report, the Cape Times. You've got to know your enemy. And Antonio Gramsci, he was the founder of the Communist Party in Italy, and he said, we must work like cultural termites. We've got to eat out the insides of the wooden structure, the beams, and the structure of the house, and let the bourgeois capitalists keep putting whitewash and paint on the outside. It doesn't matter. One day, the whole structure is going to just collapse. We have eaten the heart out of all the Western institutions. He spoke about the long march through education, entertainment, news media, religious institutions, political institutions. Interestingly enough, when Bill Clinton came to power as President of the United States, he was asked, who is your mentor? Who do you look to as your role model enough? He said, Antonio Gramsci. Incredible. Well, know your enemy. The Gramsci strategy. And of course, they started class war music, to use music to promote class war. And you can see it. In fact, rock and roll, jazz, a lot of these things were designed to rebel against the structures, to go against all the norms of rhythm and melody, and to smash the cultural norms. Basically, the goal has been, especially you can see it in hip-hop and rap. It's like gangster pimp music. It's just designed to rot the soul and the brain. KGB General Oleg Kalugin described active measures as the heart and soul of Soviet intelligence, meaning the KGB. Kalugin described active measures as subversion. Active measures to weaken the West, to drive wedges in the Western community alliances of all sorts, particularly NATO, North Atlantic Treaty Organization, to sow discord amongst allies. To weaken the United States alliance to the people of Europe, Asia and Africa, Latin America, and thus to prepare the ground for revolution. That's active measures' goal, main goal. The Andropov Institute of the KGB in Yasinovo, near Moscow, taught active measures as a system of special courses. Andropov Institute, named after the KGB leader who later became chairman of the whole of the Soviet Union. The head of active measures department was Yuri Modin, former controller of the Cambridge Five spy ring, which effectively undermined, in fact, gutted British intelligence for decades. The embarrassing thing is that during the heyday of the James Bond books and films, the KGB was running MI5 and MI6, basically. Some of the most famous active measures conducted by the KGB that are documented by the declassified archives now include stirring up racial tensions in the United States by staging incidents in the 1960s and mailing bogus letters reported to come from the Ku Klux Klan, placing explosive packages in Negro sections of the American population under what they called Operation Pandora, opening up Pandora's box. So they started the race war in America. And fabricating a story that the AIDS virus was manufactured by U.S. scientists, which there's a lot of people I've met in Africa who still believe that. I've met people in the Congo say, yeah, America made the AIDS virus. This is a classic KGB active measures thing. One Soviet department, the GRU, alone spent more than $1 billion to fund the peace movements in America to protest the Vietnam War. Imagine what you could do with $1 billion. And that's $1 billion in 1960s, 1970s money. That's a lot of money even today, but gee. They described these movements as a hugely successful campaign and well worth the cost. In fact, the Vietnamese general in charge of the Vietnamese army, when they won the war in 1975, they said, "We never won the Vietnam War in the rice fields in Vietnam. In fact, we lost the battles on the ground here. We won on the TV, in the university campuses, in the newspapers of America." And it's true. The first war in history won entirely by active measures. They lost the military war, but they lost the battles, the military battles. But they won the war by political active measures, psychological warfare, basically. And you could say the same for South Africa. We never lost the war in Angola or Southwest Africa. We won every battle. We never even lost a skirmish. But the country was handed over because of the active measures that cut out the heart of resistance within the country. Everything, carrot and stick, sanctions, can't play in the Olympics, can't play rugby and cricket. And then they dangle the carrot. You can play cricket in Australia if you'll just be good boys and hand over and things like this. And it was a very clever thing. Guilt manipulation, psychological warfare, psyops. So they said these moves were hugely successful, much more effective than building more T-34 tanks and missiles. Stanislav Lunev claimed the GRU, that's military intelligence, and KGB, secret police, helped to fund every anti-war movement and organization in America, Great Britain, throughout Europe, and South Africa. Our groups that we had here, like the End Conscription Campaign, ECC, which I called Every Coward's Choice, they funded it. I mean, no wonder these guys had no shortage of money. They could print full color everything, all sorts of, organize, you name it, conferences, all expenses paid, fly people in from around, you know, just, of course, no shortage of money. According to Oleg Kalugin, Soviet intelligence was really unparalleled. A KGB program which could run all kinds of congresses, peace conferences, youth congresses, festivals, women's movements, trade union movements, campaigns against the US in Europe. And they produced magazines like these, the Soviet League of Militant Godless. Allegations that AIDS was invented by the CIA, all kinds of forgeries, fake materials that were targeted at politicians, academic community, and the public at large. Most people can't tell when you've got a government with a resource like the Soviet Union, and they produce some fake document. Few people could tell the difference between that and the real thing. The KGB was involved in undermining and installing governments, like invading Prague when the Czechoslovakians wanted to go free, or Hungary during the Hungarian uprising, installing puppet communist regimes throughout the whole of Eastern Europe. They installed the communists in the Soviets installed the communists in the People's Republic of China and North Korea. At the moment, America's really worked up about North Korea, but I mean, remember, who gave North Korea to the Soviet Union? Well, Harry Truman did. At the end of the Second World War, they had no reason, they didn't need to hand it over to the Soviets, but they did. They gave North Korea to the communists, and they gave all of China to the Soviets after getting rid of the main anti-communist force in Asia, which was Japan. The KGB coordinated mass political repressions and establishment of subordinate secret services like the Stasi in East Germany, who shot citizens in the back for trying to leave East Berlin for West Berlin, in all their occupied territories. And the last attempted coup organized by the KGB was the uprising against Boris Yeltsin during the Russian constitutional crisis of 1993, and this led to the abolition of the KGB and its replacement with the FSS, or the Federal Security Service, and the Federal Intelligence Service of the Russian Federation. So one of the tactics used by the KGB was an agent provocateur, that is, an inciting agent. An agent provocateur is an undercover agent who acts to incite another person to commit an illegal or rash act, or falsely implicates others in taking part in an illegal act. Agent provocateurs are many and all over the place, and our country is full of them too. Often, I mean, for example, you may have a whole lot of farmers marching against farm murders or something, and then one person will post something that is stupid, insensitive, rash, dumb, or raise some flag in order to upset people. And that's what the whole media and government will focus on. And it's probably their person who did it specifically for that purpose. You know, it's the aim of an agent provocateur is to discredit the movement, to harm it, by provoking them to commit a crime or to implicate them in a crime, to undermine the whole group or protest or movement as a whole. And how easy is it to infiltrate the Ku Klux Klan? I mean, these guys wear masks. I mean, gee, this is really easy. You can infiltrate. All you got to do is dress in one of these kind of outfits and say, and how can you prove that? Well, that wasn't one of us who said that. Well, there's no way you can prove it. So this is like the easiest group to infiltrate on the planet. And so there's a lot of things that they do like that. In the trust operation of 1921 to 1926, the Soviets set up false anti-Bolshevik underground groups, including the Monarchist Union of Central Russia, to control and neutralize monarchists and other counter-revolutionaries. So they've taken over the Soviet Russia, they've made it Soviet Union. They've murdered the Tsar, the Queen, and the whole royal family, including the princesses. They have butchered people by the millions. Now, what's going to happen? There's going to be a counter-revolution. So what do they do? They set up the counter-revolutionary groups already because they know they're going to spring up. And so every monarchist, every anti-communist group is going to join the groups that they've set up. So they're able to know and infiltrate and neutralize it. Just like the National Party, knowing that there would be opposition to their détente and so-called, well, whatever they were calling it, it's hard to call it anything but Volksverein now. So they got a security police sergeant, Eugene Tabanche, to start up the Afrikaner Weerstandsbewerking, AWB. He was always working for the government. He was an agent provocateur. He had a false flag operation, very false flag, 777, black 777s in a white circle, red flag. Now, where did they get this idea from? And that's why everything the AWB did, and there were a lot of good people in AWB, but they didn't know that the leader of it was reporting back to the security police, and he was a paid agent of the state all along. Now, I only learned this from the head of military intelligence, General Tini Hrunewald, who told me afterwards that, no, here's our man. That's why nothing the AWB did ever worked, because everything was betrayed ahead of time. That's why even the Eisterkader, which was all ex-reconnaissance commanders, as the first thing they did to try to counter the betrayal of the country, they were all arrested. Why? They wouldn't guess that the founder of the movement was actually working for the enemy. This is how the Soviets work. Trust operation. They started it back. They got millions of donations towards the anti-Bolshevik groups that they set up, and they were able to know what everyone was doing ahead of time. The KGB used provocateurs to entrap and discredit the anti-communist groups, which they described as reactionaries and counter-revolutionaries. So, here you've got these people involved in these initiation rites, and who knows how many people on those bedsheets are actually working for the KGB. After the Second World War, many NKVD agents were sent to join and penetrate independence movements and to create papal rebel forces, who were even permitted to attack local Soviet authorities and murder local commissars to gain credibility and exfiltrate senior NKVD agents to the West and to neutralize and betray true resistance movements and partisans. Because we couldn't imagine, I mean, if this person has, he's walked up there and we've seen him stab a KGB border guard in the back and or slit his throat or shoot a commissar. I mean, now we know he's one of ours. Not necessarily. Life means nothing to them. It's for the good of the cause, remember. And so they were able to infiltrate or exfiltrate their NKVD agents to the West, totally trusted because they were willing to, no problem, they were ordered, you know, it's okay, you can kill some of our people, that's fine. KGB General Alexander Sakharovsky declared, in today's world when nuclear arms have made worldwide force obsolete, terrorism should become our main weapon. And so they trained the national liberation movements worldwide. There is not one national liberation movement or terrorist group in the world that the Soviets or the Chinese didn't start. They started them from the beginning. And all these people who thought that they were fighting for freedom, they didn't realize they were just puppets in the hands of the Soviet Empire. Now this man, Ion Makaya Pasepa, you may not have heard his name before, but Ian Fleming, the author of the James Bond film, says he modeled James Bond on Ian Maya Pasepa, who's a KGB agent. Now, Ian Fleming himself was an SOE operative. He has British intelligence during the war. But he modeled it on this womanizing, drinking, gambling Ian Masepa, Makaya Pasepa. He declared that the KGB was the primary instructor of guerrillas worldwide. General Sikorsky claimed, aeroplane hijacking is my own invention. I mean, cooked up in the KGB. Interesting. Doesn't quite look like the James Bonds we see in the movies, but apparently that's what Ian Fleming had in mind. In 1969 alone, 82 aircraft were hijacked worldwide just by the KGB-financed PLO. And this is one of the most famous, the TWA hijacking in Lebanon. And Swiss Air even got hijacked. Pan Am blown up. This aircraft was blown up by PFLP terrorists, even more extreme than PLO. The wreckage of Pan Am Flight 93, which detonated over Scotland, 88. That's just 1988. That's just still in days of Ronald Reagan. The KGB established the PLO. Yasser Arafat was effectively a KGB agent, knowingly. National Liberation Army of Bolivia, with the help of UNESCO, Che Guevara, all KGB operations, totally. There was a time when the KGB owned all those places in dark. It's all their people running the show. They started revolutions all over the world, as close a field as Mozambique, Zambia, Zimbabwe, and of course the ANC was under them too. And so, when I was born and brought up in this part of the world, we were aflame with revolutions, and communism was behind all of them. Every last blasted one. SWAPO. You can see the Soviet Cyrillic script on their mortars, or Chinese. You can see where they came from. The car bombs in Kalahari Sands in Windhoek. ZANU-PF in Zimbabwe. ZAPU in Zimbabwe. The people who are murdering the Matabele in Zimbabwe, bayoneting people in the backs, cutting off their ears and their lips, murdering the missionaries. All of these KGB-trained, KGB-funded, KGB-operated, Soviet heat-seeking Strela missile taking out Rhodesian civilian aircraft, and some of the terrorists cooking and eating the survivors. And here is ZAPU chief Josh Nkoma in his Soviet field marshal's cap and uniform, bragging, "We did it," with the Russians' missiles, which he did. And this creep, just a puppet of Red China, that's all. I mean, he's no national liberation freedom fighter, anything. He's just a puppet. He's a pawn, or maybe a rook, in the hands of this KGB. And these people, they think they're fighting for freedom. They have no idea. They're not even pawns. They're lower than that. They're just cannon fodder for the revolution. They are working for empires, for imperialists. They don't realize that, but this person probably does. Frelimo in Mozambique, you can kind of guess. The way they started off, there's a little bit of red here. Well, a little bit of red here, a bit more red there, lots of red there. Finally, forget about the melees. Let's just go back to Yellow Star and the hammer and the hoe. Why? The hammer for the workers in the factories, the hoe for the peasants in the fields. MPLA, red and black, yellow. Well, the red speaks about their politics and the yellow speaks about their spines. Boy, were they cowards. I mean, a moment, there could just be one platoon of South Africans and hundreds of them would flee. You know, really, spineless wimps. But anyway, the flags kind of tell you something. By the way, if you go to Australia today, they've got a flag for the Aborigines, which Aborigines never had a flag, but they made one in the 1970s. And it's red and black, and it's got a yellow star or yellow sun in the middle. Looks, sort of reminds you of the MPLA's Angola flag. And, of course, the ANC in South Africa. We've got the documentation on our shelves from the Denton Commission in U.S. Senate, from given direct Bartholomew Klopani, Southern Communist Party, Politburo member, identifying the Southern Communist Party owns the ANC. The ANC is totally and completely controlled by the Southern Communist Party. And the Southern Communist Party is completely controlled by the KGB. Pan-African Congress in Southern Africa, well, they were also pawns of an outer string of the KGB that believes, guys believe in diversification. You know, don't put all your eggs in one basket. The KGB was also implicated in Mehemet Ali Agca's 1981 assassination attempt of the Pope. Pope John Paul II had strong links with the anti-communist solidarity movement in Poland. Solidarity was a pain in the neck for the Soviets in China, in Poland. The communists hated them. And they were really, really causing grief. They helped bring down the Berlin Wall. And so Solidarity's Lech Walesa and Pope John Paul II were basically friends. And they were helping one another. And so here's Mehemet Ali Agca, who's a KGB operative. There's the gun right there, seconds before he shot him in St. Peter's Square in Vatican City in 1981. Well, El Papa the Pope knows a good public relations act when he can make it, so he even met with this criminal in his prison cell and prayed with him. And Lech Walesa succeeded, became the first president of an independent Poland in 1990, so good for him. The GRU, that's the military intelligence of the Soviet Union, recruited Elgar Hiss, an American lawyer and State Department official who later became the first General Secretary of the United Nations. Elgar Hiss. Started in San Francisco. And by the way, who's one of the key people at the beginning? Nelson Rockefeller. Who provided the space and the building for the headquarters? I mean, how much clearer is it who these people belong to? Elgar Hiss was identified by Whittaker Chambers, a former Communist Party member, as a Soviet agent. And Whittaker Chambers testified and exposed Elgar Hiss, who was convicted for being a communist spy, a Soviet agent, and a liar, and all the rest, guilty of perjury. He also identified Lawrence Duggan and Michael Straits in the State Department and Harry Dexter White in the Treasury Department as Soviet agents. Now, that's pretty serious because Harry Dexter White, Soviet spy, became the founder of the International Monetary Fund and the World Bank, which is still causing havoc to this day. Now, of all the active measures, this is the classic. And I remember studying this in military intelligence in the army. The Profumo scandal. This brought down Harold Macmillan's conservative government in Great Britain. And it brought the Labour Party to power in the 1964 general election. It was a masterful example of KGB active measures, including entrapment, honey trap as they call it, propaganda and assassination. John Profumo was a war hero, decorated, and Secretary of State for War in Britain. Very highly respected, married to an actress, and he was the war minister or Secretary for War. He is involved for a short time with an affair with Christine Keeler, a 19-year-old model. Extremely foolish, extremely unwise, but what made it even worse was that Christine Keeler was actually being controlled by KGB chap Stephen Ward, and she was the girlfriend of Captain Yevgeny Ivanov, the Soviet naval attaché, effectively the KGB's top man in London. So the British War Secretary, like our Minister of Defence, and the KGB man in London are sharing the same girlfriend, who's controlled by a KGB man anyway, Ward. Now, that's bad enough. But although this affair ended in 1962, the KGB active measures restrained the media from publishing this for a year after it ended and timed it to release in 1963, just before the general elections. Now, how is that for self-control? I mean, when the media knows a scandal, how do you shut them all up to time it to affect general election? Because, you know, if you have a scandal erupting a year before the elections, it's not going to affect the elections much. But if you time it just before and you can surf that, it'll kill the government or the sitting government, and he represents the Conservative government. Profumo had to quit 48-year-old war minister who is at the summit. I mean, he could have been the next prime minister, actually. He was really on his way to the top. And he was a strong anti-Soviet, anti-communist man, despite being stupid enough to share a girlfriend with the KGB man in London. Now, with the Conservative government disgraced by this public scandal, the way was clear for Hugh Todd Gaitskell, the man on the right, who is the leader of the Labour Party. He had become the next Prime Minister of Great Britain, plainly, because Macmillan's disgraced, Gaitskell is the head of the Labour, Conservatives on the way out, Labour's going to be the next government, Gaitskell's going to be the next Prime Minister, right? Wrong. The abrupt, strange death of Gaitskell at age 56 left an opening for Harold Wilson, who was a kind of nobody, to come out of nowhere to exploit and seize control of the Labour Party in the surprise after they suddenly lost their leader, who dies 56, quite surprising. Therefore, Harold Wilson became the next Prime Minister of Great Britain. Now, Peter Wright's 1987 book, Spycatcher, which is banned in Britain to this day, and Soviet defector, there's not much banned in Britain, but Spycatcher's one thing. Soviet defector Antonin Galitsyn, the highest placed Soviet KGB defector to the West ever, claimed that Gaitskell was assassinated by the KGB in order to place their agent of influence, Harold Wilson, codenamed Oldman, into the key position of Prime Minister of Great Britain. How did they do that? Now, Antonin Galitsyn, major defector. I mean, his book's New Lies for Old, absolute classic. And here's, of course, Oleg Penkovsky, another KGB defector, who confirmed this. Spycatcher is written by Peter Wright, former assistant director of MI5. He was meant to be the spycatcher. He was meant to find the spies within, you know, the double agents within British MI5. And he revealed even worse than that, that Sir Roger Hollis, who is the head of MI5, the one who gave James Bond his instructions, that he is working for the KGB too. He is the fifth man of the Cambridge Five. So this is banned in Britain to this day. Notice the emblem. It's a British key, but Soviets are controlling them, and through that they're controlling Americans. Because MI6 and CIA work closely together. Spycatcher. Incredible, explosive. The book the British government tried to ban, well, they did ban it, but of course it was published in Australia, so and they tried to get him extradited, and Australians wouldn't extradite him. So Wilson oversaw the disastrous betrayal of Rhodesia and other key aspects of the British Commonwealth, as well as the implosion of the British economy and escalation of the war in Northern Ireland. For example, Harold Wilson sent the British paratroopers, which had one of my friends, Australian commando, who later became Rhodesian C Squadron SAS, Rob Brown. He said to me, he was in, there they were in the British parachute regiment, and they were shipped off to Londonderry. I thought, this is kind of strange. I mean, we're paratroopers. We're only trained to shoot. I mean, they'd never been trained in crowd control, riot control. They had no gas masks. They had no tear gas. They had no batons, shields. I mean, all they've got is the FN rifles. And there they are marching the street, and a whole lot of of people led by Roman Catholic priests are leading them up. This is Bloody Sunday, which blew Northern Ireland out of control. They march right up to the paratroopers. Here they are with their red berets. They're wearing no protective gear. All they've got is their FN rifles. And what have they been trained to do? Shoot people, actually. That's all they've ever been trained to do. Jump out of planes and kill people and survive. But here these Catholic priests lead the people up to them. And as they reach them, the crowd parted down the middle, sort of like this table. And on the ground, there were two shooters lying on the ground, and they fired straight down the middle of the crowd into the British paratroopers. And then the crowd closed up again with the Roman Catholic priest in front. And the paras just opened fire, which is exactly what the IRA wanted. And it's Harold Wilson who sent them there. I mean, what else would have happened? He ignited Northern Ireland because, I mean, British soldiers fired on a civilian crowd. But they weren't prepared for... You don't send paratroopers into a urban riot situation. They've only got one way of responding to anything. You shoot at them, they shoot back. I mean, simple. And he said the crowd was working together with the IRA gunmen, obviously. But still, the fact is, Bloody Sunday was totally organized by this man, Harold Wilson, who at the time, he was a swear word when I was growing up. Before Jimmy Carter, there was Harold Wilson. He was like number one enemy of Rhodesia. This lowlife Harold Wilson is the one who refused Rhodesia its independence. Now, while they were giving cannibals like Kenyatta Kenya and communist terrorists like Kenneth Kaunda Zambia, but southern Rhodesia, which had never taken a penny or a pound of British money or a single British soldier, we would deny their independence. Why? I mean, Rhodesia was self-governing, self-supporting. It had contributed more men, percentage of population, to the British Commonwealth and Empire for the First, Second World War, Malayan conflict. But no, they can give commies and cannibals countries, but they can't give a well-organized country like Rhodesia its independence. So Rhodesia went alone. And Harold Wilson's the one who betrayed Rhodesia to such an extent that Rhodesia was sanctioned and its independence wasn't recognized. You know, you could be anything, any kind of communist mass-murdering thug and cannibal out there, and you could be recognized at the UN. But Rhodesia was sanctioned and boycotted, not even allowed to take part in the Olympics, starting with the Munich Olympics in 1972, for example. So Harold Wilson was right in the middle of this. Now, Harold Wilson also betrayed five Soviet spies working for the CIA. They were all imprisoned and subsequently executed by the KGB. Now, how was this all done? Harold Wilson was a KGB operative, and he became Prime Minister of Britain at a key time and basically dismantled what was left of the British Empire and imploded the British pound and made sure Northern Ireland erupted so that it could not subside for the next 3 or 4 decades. Hugh Gaitskell, who was the head of the Labour Party, who is about to become the next Prime Minister of Britain, was suddenly invited for a visit to Russia, which, well, that's very nice. All expenses paid and so on. But you've got to go and get your visa yourself. And his secretary was sent back. Very strange that he had to go personally to the Russian embassy to get his visa. So he goes to the Russian embassy. Time confirmed. His time's very precious. Nevertheless, when he gets there, not really. Sorry, just wait a few moments. A few more things to be done. What? Stamp and a passport. It's nothing. He's the next Prime Minister of Great Britain. How difficult is this? And while he's waiting, they serve him tea and biscuits. And a couple of days later, he dies of a rare liver disease. Now, years later, Chapman Pinchner, who's an espionage writer, came across from Soviet academic papers that Soviet scientists had discovered a way of introducing this rare liver disease, the very same, through either solid, and they gave the example like a biscuit, or liquid, and they gave an example like tea, both of which Hugh Gaitskell had. So for years we were speculating maybe Hugh Gaitskell was assassinated. But when the Berlin Wall came down, the Soviet Union collapsed, and the KGB files were opened, it was discovered actually Harold Wilson was a KGB agent. Hugh Gaitskell was assassinated by that very means of this rare liver disease. And so here the Soviet KGB active measures were able to manipulate an entrapment of the British Minister of War, who is about to be a future Prime Minister, bring down the Conservative government, kill a key man who manipulate the press of Britain not to blow this scandal too soon so it can influence the election, and then assassinate a man who's about to be the next prime minister. So the characters assassinate one, they assassinate another, they bring down a party, they control the media, and then they're able to see that their man becomes Prime Minister of Great Britain at a key time, and he dismantles what's left of the British Empire, implodes the British pound, sets Northern Ireland ablaze, and all the rest of it. I mean, Harold Wilson was a catastrophe, but a great success from the Soviets' point of view. A spate of Soviet agents infiltrate British intelligence agencies during and after the Second World War and throughout much of the Cold War. Blunt and Donald McLean and Guy Burgess and Kim Philby. These were four of the worst. These are the famous Cambridge Five. Donald McLean, Guy Burgess, who was the homosexual of the group, and looks a very seedy character there. Anthony Blunt, who was the Queen's decorator. He's the one who advised the Queen on all of her internal decorations and so on. He's the only one of the Cambridge Five who expressed any kind of remorse. Michael Strait was recruited by Blunt as a mole for them, and he was very effective for them too. John Cancross was another one recruited by the Cambridge Five. Kim Philby was the worst of them all in many ways. He was the one who was directly involved in the assassination of General Sikorsky, the Polish commander-in-chief and the head of the government in exile of Poland. Kim Philby ended his life as a KGB colonel in retirement in Moscow with the Order of Lenin as an award. And here he is with Oleg Kalugin. And the man with the Cheshire smile, Sir Roger Hollis, M. This is the man who gave James Bond and all the 00s their instructions from 1945 to 1968. This really ruins a lot of James Bond books and films when you know this. Sir Roger Hollis did incalculable damage to Great Britain and the free world, and who knows how many thousands of agents, informants, throughout the East Bloc countries were betrayed by this character and his moles. And so Yuri Modin, head of active measures, writes a book, My Five Cambridge Friends. And notice he's got these five hands. They're all right hands. They've all got a hammer and sickle in them. By their KGB controller, that's the term he used, the controller. Yuri Modin, he is like the KGB's top man. It's unlikely that any other intelligence agency in history has been responsible for as many arrests, tortures, imprisonments, murders, massacres, assassinations, launching of foreign wars, sponsoring and training of foreign terrorist movements, toppling of governments, and funding of so many revolutionary movements worldwide as the KGB. The Black Book of Communism catalogues over 100 million deaths caused between 1917 and 1991 alone, caused by communist governments. Most of them by the Soviet Union, controlled by the Soviet Union or its agents. This does not include most of the death toll of Red China because we don't have their files open yet. This is just for the Soviet files. Now, if you were to add the casualties of the wars of liberation, like in Mozambique and Angola and the Congo and Ethiopia, worldwide, the body count would double. Now, just in case you think I'm just picking on the Russians, the British government admitted bombing five ships transporting Jews from Europe to Palestine between 1946 and 1948, setting up a fake group called the Defenders of Palestine to falsely claim responsibility for these bombings. Gee. In 1954, Israel admitted launching a terrorist cell to operate in Egypt, planting bombs in several buildings, including the US diplomatic facilities, including British MGM, Metro-Goldwyn-Mayer Cinema, and so on, and libraries, leaving behind false evidence indicating Arabs are culprits. And so they activated the cell in 1954, but became known in 1955, and it was a very public trial, and several of these Israeli agents cracked and revealed the details. So to deflect the blame, the Israeli government tried to frame its own Minister of Defense, Phineas Lavon, but most people believe he was only acting on the instructions of the Prime Minister anyway. So when one of the bombs detonated prematurely, it enabled the Egyptians to identify the bombers, and several of the Israeli agents confessed to this false flag operation. So this is a case where they were planting evidence in order to make the Americans, who were, the Americans were starting to have a good relationship with Egypt under Nasser. And so to ruin the relationship with them, they were going to have bombs against the Americans in Egypt, blame it on the Egyptians, and hopefully destroy America's good relationship with the Nasser government. Then you get Operation Ajax. This is one of the most insidious of all because the results are still with us in the Ayatollah's Iran. The CIA admitted hiring Iranians in the 1950s to pose as communists and stage bombings in Iran in order to turn the country against its elected prime minister. Now, bear in mind that Britain had already invaded Iran in 1941, in cooperation with the Russians. The Russians invade the north, the British invade the south, took over Iran, Persia, and threatened to conquer it to send aid to the Soviet Union during the war, and later hand over to the Americans. So they've already toppled one government, now they topple another. The Central Intelligence Agency was behind the overthrow of Iranian Prime Minister Mohammad Mossadegh in 1953. Now, at that stage, Winston Churchill was Prime Minister of Britain, and Truman was Truman was no longer the head in America. It was now Eisenhower. Eisenhower had just come in. And in fact, Truman had thrown out this plan earlier when they tried to do it, but now Eisenhower is cooperating. So 1953 coup, the British MI6 and the American CIA cooperated to overthrow the elected government and replace with the dictatorship in Iran. And this is called Operation Ajax. And you think, why? Because they wanted to control, or more correctly, they wanted BP, British Petroleum, the same people down the road, the petrol station, BP to control the petroleum that came out of Iran. And as a result of this, BP managed to talk the American and British governments into staging a coup to change the government to get better arrangements for their company controlling the oil coming out of Iran. It's a disgusting, seedy thing. And if you pay attention to Iranian propaganda, the Iranians justify their incredibly oppressive, evil government they've got today. I mean, I don't want to say a good thing about the Iranian government today, but they're using that as propaganda to justify what they're doing. That, well, you know, look what the British and the Americans did to us. And to be honest, they've got a justification there, but that doesn't excuse their persecution of the church and their oppression that they've got today. But still, Iran was a democracy, and it first got messed up and derailed by CIA, MI6 operation by Eisenhower and Churchill. And interestingly enough, a grandson of Teddy Roosevelt, his grandson, I forget his first name right now, he was the key man on the CIA who handled the whole operation. As I said, Operation Ajax was always a bit of an open secret. So a few years ago, they produced some film, Hollywood film, which this character got an Oscar for. And as I say, the CIA has given him this award and the chance to gain support through the use of propaganda, because this basically was how filmmakers in Hollywood helped the CIA get some of their operatives out of Iran during the whole revolution there. Without mentioning Operation Ajax, which actually ultimately led to the hostage crisis in the first place, because the hostage crisis was wanting the Allies to return the money that was stolen, to apologize for what they had done. And so it was directly related to Operation Ajax, the pretext for the hostage crisis, the 444 days. Very interesting. Well, Turkey gets a prize for false flag operation. Boy, have they had a lot of false flag operations. The Turkish Prime Minister admitted that the Turkish government carried out the September 5, 1955 bombings of the Turkish consulate in Thessalonica in Greece. And they also damaged the nearby birthplace of the founder of modern Turkey, Atatürk, blaming it on Greece for the purpose of inciting and justifying anti-Greek violence. So they bombed their own embassy, damaged their own sacred place, and then, as a result, 4,000 Greek shops were sacked and plundered, 38 churches were burned down, 35 more churches were vandalized, 2 monasteries, the main Greek Orthodox cemeteries in Constantinople were vandalized, in some cases destroyed. More than 2,000 Greek homes were vandalized and robbed. 52 Greek schools were stripped of their furniture, their books and their equipment. And this lethal pogrom from the 6th to the 7th of September 1955, in 7 hours, dealt a fatal blow, killing Greek community and Hellenism in Constantinople. Remember, it used to be a Greek major capital, and the Greek civilization in Asia Minor was snuffed out in 7 hours, and they initiated by a bombing on their own embassy and blaming it on the Greeks. And this is from the Anti-Christian Riots in Constantinople, 1955, and after that they changed the name from Constantinople to Istanbul. 53 years ago, the Greek minority in Istanbul were targeted in this crisis, carefully fabricated by the Turkish security service. As was once said, who said this? FDR. If something happens in politics, it wasn't an accident. It was meant to happen. There are no accidents in politics. That's his quote. Then you get the Syrian deception operations have been around a long time. British Prime Minister Harold Macmillan admitted that both he and American President Dwight Eisenhower approved the CIA-MI6 joint operation in 1956 to carry out attacks in Syria and blame it on the Syrian government. Does this sound familiar? Mm-hmm. As a way of effecting regime change. So the Syrian government, which was a very moderate look at the Syrian government back then. You don't see any turbans, you don't see any... I mean, there were no radical Islamists. These guys were pretty secular, there was religious freedom there. But the radicalization has come by these terrorist tactics. By this character resigned his office. When he retired, he gave a speech warning about the danger of the military-industrial complex. Well, he should know. Gee, he was part of it. He was part of it. And why he chose this final speech to warn about the military-industrial complex, I don't know, because he sure was a servant of it in every way. Then you get terror bombings in Europe. This is one of the more unbelievable ones. A former Italian prime minister and an Italian judge and a former head of Italian counterintelligence admitted in court that NATO, the North Atlantic Treaty Organization, with the help of the Pentagon and the CIA, carried out terror bombings in Italy and other European countries throughout the 1950s in order to rally people's support for their governments in Europe. A lot of people weren't convinced about the need for a united NATO military, centralized, like, we've had these wars. And so they organized terror attacks on their own people. We had to attack civilians, people, women, children, innocent people, unknown people, far removed from any political gain. The reason was quite simple. They were supposed to force these people, the Italian public, to turn to the state to ask for greater security. I mean, is this even believable? And there's books on this. NATO secret armies, Operation Gladio. I don't know if you've heard of Operation Gladio. The Vatican's even involved, as was the Mafia. The CIA made an alliance with them all on this. These terror attacks carried out throughout Italy, France, Belgium, Denmark, Germany, Greece, Netherlands, Norway, Portugal, the United Kingdom, and he says other countries, was carried out. The CIA was in some cases using Vatican and Mafia contacts to carry out these attacks. It's like protection money. We need to be paid to protect you. I don't need any protection. Next thing they come with a baseball bat, break your legs, burn your store, smash your windows. I've got to pay protection money to you to protect me from you. That's the way it works, you know. Make you an offer, you can't refuse. So, what's the difference between the Mafia and the government? Well, the Mafia is more efficient. Sorry?
They've got a monopoly on lawmaking.
Yeah, and the Mafia's got some honor. NATO's secret armies, Operation Gladio, and terrorism in Western Europe. I mean, is it possible that NATO was using terrorism to convince their people why they needed NATO?
And the EU.
Yes, and the EU. And the EU was founded on the Club of Rome Declaration. Nahum 3:1 says, it is all full of lies and robbery. Its victims never depart. The National Security Agency of America, the NSA, admitted that it lied about what happened in the Gulf of Tonkin incident. You think, well, what difference does that make? Well, the Gulf of Tonkin incident of 1964 is a justification for the Vietnam War, in which a few million Vietnamese and about 55,000 Americans died. They manipulated the data to make it look like North Vietnamese boats had fired on U.S. battleships. In fact, this is, you can tell it's not a photograph, it's a painting. Well, it has to be a painting because it didn't happen. But we're to believe that three incredibly brave Vietnamese torpedo boats attacked an American warship, the USS Maddox. Well, I mean, how stupid is that? What, you know, would a mouse want to attack an elephant? This was to create a justification for American involvement in the Vietnam War. And so, first of all, what on earth were all those warships doing in the Gulf of Tonkin, which is not exactly America, you know, this is not Kansas anymore. And they're going really close to shore, and so it looks like they were inciting an incident, and because one didn't happen, they just manufactured one anyway. And Lyndon Johnson, who, I mean, we're not even going to talk about the assassination of JFK tonight, but Lyndon Johnson has his whole bunch behind him, and they have a joint resolution as the Gulf of Tonkin resolution, which basically, the amazing thing about this is how the US media just parroted the official version. I mean, no question. They take the government propaganda and it's unbelievable. That's why people are talking about prostitutes. They don't do investigative journalism. They don't question. They just, oh, okay. And they give the propaganda. And this opened the floodgates of the Vietnam War. You can't calculate how much chemical warfare was dumped on the forests of Vietnam. Agent Orange. How many tens of thousands of servicemen are suffering to this day or have already died as a result of the chemical warfare or the bombings, or how many lives are ruined, wrecked, crippled, mutilated by this totally and utterly pointless war. And Lyndon Johnson said at that time, he says, for all I know, our Navy was shooting at whales out there, you know, but it didn't stop him from a totally prefabricated incident. Now, here they're calling it flawed intelligence. Was it flawed intelligence, or were they ordered to give a flawed result? I mean, many times, because secrecy is involved, you don't know, were they just stupid, or was this completely prefabricated? There were people in the military-industrial complex who made billions out of manufacturing the weapons and so on. You think when America left Vietnam, how many thousands of helicopters they left behind? How many, they were pushing them off their decks into the sea. How the people who manufactured those, they got paid. Okay, US taxpayers probably still paying the interest on those things, but the fact is there's companies that did a lot of good out of the war. That's a bit rough on the people who are fighting on both sides, but and the people caught in the crossfire. But I mean, you know, look at the big picture. Some companies really made a mint. Okay. This one is one of the most bizarre of all. The bombing of the USS Liberty. On the 8th of June, 1967, 4 days into the Six-Day War, unmarked Israeli fighter jets. So this picture's inaccurate, but they're just trying to make a point in this picture. But still, unmarked Israeli fighter jets and Israeli torpedo boats attacked the USS Liberty, which happened to be the most advanced espionage naval vessel in the world at that time. It was off the coast of Egypt. It's 4 days into the Six-Day War, and suddenly it's attacked with cannon fire, napalm, rockets, and torpedoes. The attack started by the jamming of the ship's emergency distress channel, which indicates already they knew it was an American ship, because how did they know the right channel to block? They then targeted the communication system of the ship. Notice the mast and so on. They just poured in all the rocket, 30mm rocket fire to that. To prevent the Americans radioing for help. Sailors attempting to escape in life rafts were shot to prevent any survivors escaping. This is what the communications room looked like. And a torpedo hit, and there's an entrance and there's an exit. And basically you can see 30mm holes, and it was napalmed. It's just unbelievable what the ship went through. The fact that it was still... It actually managed to leave the area alive without the ship. It was dead in the water, but it was towed by others. It didn't sink, incredibly. 34 American crewmen were killed, 174 wounded. This attack went on for hours, by the way, hours. And when one of their men actually crawled out and raised a new improvised aerial that they could send out distress signals with other radio methods and so on, and there were U.S. ships and planes on the way there, and the Secretary of Defense, McNamara, ordered them to return. The first time in history, I'm told, if not the only time, that a U.S. ship under fire was denied assistance, and this carried on for 3 hours, the attack. And only when the attack completely had failed to sink the ship and the mist was going out, and they were now broadcasting so that the Lebanon embassy picked it up and the German military base picked up their distress calls and so on. So a lot of people knew, and only at that point, okay, secrecy's gone, they had to leave them. And so many of the ship's crew were wounded. They handed out 200 Purple Hearts. There's never been a ship in the history of America that's gotten more decorations. They dished out Silver Stars and Bronze Medals and Purple Hearts by the bucket load. I mean, 200 Purple Hearts. Right. You get a Purple Heart if you're wounded in action. There's never been a ship more decorated than this ship in U.S. history. This is what it looked like. Okay, the Israeli cover story is, we mistook this ship from the El Khazar, which is half the length and a quarter of the tonnage and a very different profile. And so they had 2 hours of bombing a ship without having noticed the difference. And it had a very large U.S. flag up there. But nevertheless, and had the American markings on the side. And there's no difference. There's no doubt that that ship and that ship are kind of like different. Well, this is Rear Admiral Mora. And Admiral Thomas Mora, former chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, that's like top. He spent a year investigating the incident, and he concluded the attempted sinking of the USS Liberty was a failed false flag attack. Israel was attempting to sink an American ship with no survivors, blame Egypt for the attack, and persuade America to join in on the attack on Egypt. And this wasn't just trying to fool the Americans. The evidence is that President Lyndon Johnson and the Secretary for McNamara were in on it and agreed with it. Because President Lyndon Johnson apparently was dispatching nuclear-armed fighter jets to drop nuclear bombs in Cairo, Egypt, when the people in Lebanon and the people in Cyprus and the embassies the American embassy in Germany were all saying, we've heard about this Israeli attack, torpedo boats on our gun. So the word was out. I mean, there was no more secrecy. They had to return. There is actually, these are the facts. That it was a deliberate attack. They knew there are Israeli people who took part in that day who have testified. We knew it was an Israeli attack. In fact, there was only one person jailed for this, and it's the one pilot who, when he saw the American flag and signs, he refused to fire. He was told, you must continue the attack. When he landed, they arrested him, and he went to jail as a result for refusing orders to attack the ship. The only person arrested is the one who actually refused to fire on a ship. But it becomes more than that. This conspiracy goes all the way up to LBJ. When the people were saying, but our ship's under attack, LBJ said to them, I want that goddamn ship on the ocean floor. And the Admiral, Mora, actually had the people involved. He spoke to them, and he's gotten the sworn testimonies from people involved on all levels. He spent a year investigating this. And as a person who used to be chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, he had a lot of clout. But there was no doubt that, and by the way, when they gave everyone all their medals and so on of the ship, they were warned never to talk to anyone about this game, or you will be thrown in jail for the rest of your lives. And some of them were actually told, you know, you'll be killed if you ever speak about what happened. And, well, of course, some did speak. And the whole book's out exposing this. It was not just a false flag from Israel's side, but the U.S. government was willing to sacrifice their own ship for this end. And Lyndon Johnson was apparently quite angry that he missed his opportunity to have an excellent, another Gulf of Tonkin. You know, our ship's been attacked by Egypt there, and, you know, we've got to go to war like we went in Vietnam, and now we wage nuclear war on Egypt. And, yeah, this would have suited some people, but sacrifice your own people? So these are just some of the people killed there, from Lieutenant Commander all the way down, killed on the 8th of June, 1967. This is a nation that does not obey the voice of the Lord their God, nor receive correction. Truth has perished and has been cut off from their mouth. The Turks, who have got to get a gold medal for false flag operations, a Turkish general admitted that Turkish forces burned down a mosque on the island of Cyprus in the 1970s to blame it on the Greek Christian enemy. He explained in special ways certain acts of sabotage are staged and blamed on the enemy to increase public resistance. We did this in Cyprus. We even burned down a mosque. And so this was the Turks attacked their own people to justify a Turkish invasion of Cyprus, and they managed to take half of the island. This is what they called Operation Attila. You think of Attila the Hun. And so to this day, Cyprus is divided between the Turkish and the Greek-controlled sections, with the UN having one of the longest military peacekeeping operations in the middle there as well. Psalm 5 verse 6, "You shall destroy those who speak falsehood. The Lord abhors the bloodthirsty and deceitful man." A Mossad agent admitted that in 1984, Israeli agents planted a radio transmitter in Gaddafi's compound in Tripoli, Libya, which broadcast fake terrorist transmissions in order to frame Gaddafi as a supporter of anti-American terrorism. And this convinced U.S. President Ronald Reagan to bomb Libya, which prepared the way for Gaddafi's fall, ultimately. "Deliver my soul, O Lord, from lying lips and from a deceitful tongue." I mean, you can see what's happened to Libya since it's been liberated. Makes the days of Gaddafi look good in comparison. An Algerian diplomat and several officers of the Algerian army admitted that in the 1990s, the Algerian army frequently massacred Algerian civilians to blame on opponents of the state. So Algeria, which is a terrorist state, I mean, it was founded by the FLN, for goodness sakes, they'll regularly do massacres of their own people and publish it and make a big thing about these poor victims, but they did it themselves to their own people. And here are the statistics of the number of civilians killed by the hundreds per month through the years in Algeria, which now the Algerian military or some aspects of it have said, yeah, actually, we were doing it ourselves. I mean, how sick is that? Then you get an Indonesian fact-finding team investigating violent riots which occurred in 1998, determined that elements of their own military had been involved in the riots, some of which they deliberately provoked. Other false flag operations include the murder of the Turkish Prime Minister in 1960. Adnan Menderes, killed by his own people, but to blame on others. I mean, false flag. The bombings in Portugal in 1966. Portugal was involved in a war in Mozambique and Angola, fighting to defend against communist terrorists, but they were also doing some false flags against themselves to rally their people to be more enthusiastic to support them. And then there's the Piazza Fontana massacre in Italy in 1969, done by the Italian government themselves, in Milan. The terror attacks in Turkey of 1971, done by the Turkish military themselves. The Patano bombings in Italy, 1972. The shootings in Brescia, Italy. And the bombing of an Italian train, 1974. Also, false flags done by themselves, to themselves. One of the coaches blown up in Italy by terrorist bombing, which now their people have admitted, well, actually, we did it ourselves. And then the shootings in Istanbul, Turkey, 1977. False flag organized by themselves. The Atocha massacre in Madrid, Spain, 1977. Five lawyers killed in Atocha Street, and here's the memorial for it, 24th January 1977. False flag. Own goal. Even the abduction and murder of the Italian Prime Minister in 1978, which was done, this is about as brutal and savage, and the bombing of the Bologna railway station in 1980. Italian military intelligence said, well, actually, we did ourselves. Just even your prime minister's just, he's a pawn who can be sacrificed for the good of the cause. Central railway station of Bologna, killing 85 people, wounding more than 200, now listed as a documented false flag. One of the worst false flags in our memory, the Oklahoma City bombing in 1995 under Bill Clinton. And we've got those videos available too, do we? We've got those really. If you haven't seen the film A Noble Lie, you need to. This is what the building looked like before. That's what it looked like afterwards. Can you imagine the damage caused by this bombing? Absolutely hideous. And these are some of the death toll and victims. You might recall this picture. This is a false flag. documented, proven, done by the US government themselves. And this man is a patsy. He, Timothy McVeigh, who got executed for it, he has a special forces soldier who had an impeccable record, who had never done anything wrong, who had always obeyed orders. And when he left the military, he told his family, his sister, and so on. Now, he's still working for the military. He's got a secret operation he's involved in. And he goes and he infiltrates a white supremacist group where it turned out in the end every single member of the group was a government agent. They were just from different agencies and didn't know it. I mean, it was everything from the NSA and the CIA and the military, police, just everything. It was just one big false flag operation, the entire thing. And he could not have done this bombing. It's absolutely, completely impossible. There's a whole lot of facts involved. First of all, the date of the bombing was to coincide with the anniversary of the Waco massacre, where the U.S. military, or I should say FBI, ATF agents, went in and wiped out, 74 people in Waco, Texas, because they believed the children might be getting spanked or something. So to prevent child abuse, they burned incinerated guests and killed them all. Well, that makes sure they can't be abused anymore. And so on the anniversary of this, there were going to be a lot of protest. On this day, the building which had the ATF headquarters is blown up, but not one ATF or FBI agent is at the building at that day. Very, very strange. All absent from work at 9 o'clock on that weekday morning, but no conspiracy. This building, this was drawn up by General Ben Parton, and you can see it on the Ben Parton website. General Ben Parton's a member of the board of Frontline. I've spent more time in his home than any other American's home. The first home I stayed in America, he's the scientist who invented cruise missiles, everything from laser, precision-guided weapons. He's a real scientist mind. And as he points out, that's the truck bomb. You had pillars disintegrated. And he says, nothing can disintegrate a pillar except a contact bomb. It's got to be on that pillar. You can't have reinforced concrete disintegrate. Doesn't matter how many TNTs you've got in that truck bomb. Doesn't matter how close it is. You've got to have plastic explosives all around it to take out the pillars. These are pillars that totally disintegrated. And you've got pillars closer that survived unscratched, and pillars further away that are disintegrated. And he showed the collapse of this building. Remember, he's America's premier weapons expert. And he went there and he said, there's no way any truck bomb took down this building. And this well documented in the film, A Noble Lie. And this DVD is a must-see. It's about 2 hours, and it's so clear. There is no question whatsoever. From the colossal cover-up and the tortures and the murders of witnesses and everything done, it, the destruction of the evidence. As somebody asked General Ben Parton on TV, do you know who did this? Because he had said, there's no way Timothy McVeigh or any truck bomb did this. He said, well, can you tell us who did? He said, I'm a retired U.S. officer under military law. No, I cannot tell you who did this, but I can tell you who's destroying the evidence. It's about the only way he could put it. He also did a study on the flight, TWA Flight 800. Now, you may recall this, that happened at almost the same time, also under Clinton. This aircraft got cut in half, and it just fell out of the sky. And one suggestion was, well, maybe some Cessna aircraft collided with it. As General Parton said, only a naval continuous rod missile could do this damage. And he knows because he designed them. Because, for example, if you've got a aircraft coming in, like a kamikaze plane or something like this, coming into your ship, you can't shoot down the plane because it'll keep coming. It'll destroy the ship still. So they invented a continuous rod missile that would be able to totally cut in half the aircraft or missile, whatever's coming at them, so that it would collapse dead in the water there. It wouldn't keep continuing. You've got to stop its aerodynamic quality so it can't keep gliding to target. And so This was a missile took out TWA-800. I don't know if you've heard of TWA-800. I sure did, because I was in his home days after it happened, and this is about all I heard for several weeks. But TWA-800, there is no doubt. The people who spoke about, they saw the missiles. It was definitely shot down. Eyewitnesses giving their testimonies, and how the FBI statements left out and lied, and the cover-ups of the Transportation Safety Board. And there's a whole lot of people talking about this total lies. So people saw the streaks of the missiles. They saw the hit, and then they saw the secondary strike, which is a burst inside. That's the fumes of an empty gas tank exploding. And so all the different things, consistent with emulation of surface-to-air missile, that's part of it, and then the leaking fuel explosion. So the two sides to it, and they've got all the different evidences that this was a shoot-down. It wasn't a crash. It was a shoot-down. Okay, so why did the plane get shot down? Well, who was on the plane is one question you can ask. But TWA-800, there is no question that it was a missile strike and it was a cover-up, and there's a conspiracy to cover up just about everything important. And it's the worst airplane disaster in American history, and it's a false flag. A lot of people are still pointing back to 17 July 1996. Then you've got the Russians blowing up a Russian apartment building in 1999, blaming it on the Chechens. The 2001 anthrax attacks in the United States. You remember the anthrax attacks?
Yeah.
I was there. Now we know it's a false flag. They did it themselves. This is a total CIA op to get the people in America hysterical, and they had these talcum powder in people's envelopes, and oh, it's anthrax. And they were clearing whole buildings, people coming out in the streets during the day. And it was a total false flag, false op. Getting everyone, I mean, walking around in these hazmat suits. And but it's totally and completely fraud. They're offering rewards if you could, you know, come who's responsible. And meanwhile, it was a total hoax. It was designed to make people willing to have total encroachment in their private correspondence. And, you know, the government could open anything, check anything, go wherever they wanted. And, as I said, manufactured terrorism. Made in the USA, CIA. The Indonesian military have admitted to killing the American teachers in Papua New Guinea and blaming it on a Papua New Guinean separatist group in order to get that group listed as a terrorist organization. Papua New Guinea, which was at one time partly under Germany, partly under England, now then became under Australia. Indonesia wants it. Indonesia's right next door. Indonesia's the largest Muslim country on earth, nation on earth. And they are trying to move into Papua New Guinea, and so they're not beyond murdering American teachers and blaming it on some separatist group. The highly respected writer for The Telegraph, Ambrose Evans Pritchard, reported that the head of Saudi military intelligence, this man, Prince Bandar, admitted to him that the Saudi government controls the Chechen terrorists. That's quite interesting. This man can travel all over. He's friends with Obama, pals with the British, Saudi chief. Ukrainian officials have admitted that their snipers fired on both sides of demonstrators in the streets to create chaos, maximum chaos, which led to the Ukrainian coup d'etat, which overthrew the pro-Russian, pro-Putin friend and installed a pro-Western one who wants to go out of the ruble, enter the euro, join the euro, European Union, join NATO. And this was all started deliberately. And we can go to the Air Malaysia flight another time. Which brings us to the main one that's up in news right now. Chemical weapons attacks in Syria. 8th of April 2014, Pulitzer Prize-winning investigative reporter Simo Herrish published an expose revealing that the Turkish government carried out chemical weapon attacks and blamed it on the Syrian government. Although Turkey's a member of NATO, they provided the sarin chemical weapons to the rebels. So, you know, you can do almost anything in this world. It's not a problem. You can bomb with phosphorus, napalm, incinerate, that's fine. I mean, you can hack people to death, that's not a problem. But you use gas and all go hysterical. It's like one own thing, a few things you can't do. US President Obama attempted to use this pretext to launch America into full-scale war against Syria back in 2013. I remember it because I was going there and speaking to her, and just about everyone was hysterical. We got to bomb Syria and so on. I was like, why? This is so obviously, even before Hirsch's expose, it just didn't make sense. Here's Syria winning the war. Why would they deliberately provoke America with the one thing that America's mentioned as the one red line? You cross this and we're going to come in military. And then, you know, they're winning the war. Chemical warfare isn't even that effective. It's more like a, like people are getting hysterical about gas warfare in the First World War. Gas warfare in the First World War didn't account for 2% of the casualties. Artillery account for 80%. But, you know, the gas is what gets the big hysteria. If you've got a choice between getting blown to pieces by artillery, burned alive by phosphorus, or gassed, you know, honestly, who'd want any of those? But gas is probably the least of the least painful of all the options when you think about it. But anyway, forget about that. High-level U.S. intelligence officers confirmed it was the U.S.-backed, Turkish-backed rebels, the Nusra Front and ISIS, not the Syrian government, who carried out the chemical weapons attacks. And this is so obvious. The U.S.-backed plan to launch chemical weapons attacks on Syria and blame it on Assad's regime is known now as a hoax, a false flag. How many have seen this picture? Young boy sleeping with his parents in Syria.
She's got a piece of propaganda.
Notice, look, what's on this page? This is Islamic values. Okay, this is a propaganda pic. Totally posed. There's no bodies there, let alone his parents. This kid just, he was paid to pose for this picture. This is a heart-pulling thing. That a friend of mine in Cape Town shared this picture the other day, and I had to share with him this and say, do you realize you just shared a piece of fake news? It's total fake. The war against Syria is built on, not a lie, but many lies, actually. Okay. Israel can attack Gaza with white phosphorus munitions, which, by the way, is banned by the Geneva Convention because phosphorus is a chemical weapon, too. Do you know what phosphorus does? If somebody set off a phosphorus grenade in here, every one of us would have a piece of burning phosphor on our skin. And the only way to get that phosphorus off your skin would be to cut it off with a knife. Because, like people who have been incinerated in Dresden with phosphorus, they dived into the canal and it took, put the fire up. The moment they came up out of the water, the phosphorus reignited. They'd go back under the water, it would go out. They'd come up again, the phosphorus reignited. You can't put out phosphorus with anything. All you can do is cut the skin off that's got the phosphorus on. That's the only way. It's a chemical weapon. Ah, phosphorus bombs on Gaza is not a problem because the phosphorus bombs come from America. The first victim of war is truth. The CIA director, Pompeo, admits that he convinced Trump to launch those 59 cruise missiles into Syria a year ago over disproven chemical weapons attack, which since then has been proved it wasn't done by the Syrians at all. But Obama wanted to invade and bomb Syria and did bomb them, invade them on the basis of the now proven by the Pulitzer Prize journalist to be fake news. This man is the most evil man in the world. He's Adolf Hitler reincarnated. He's evil incarnate. You've got to get rid of him because he's, well, we're not too sure. But anyway, you've just got to believe that. You know where this is? Damascus. Remember Road to Damascus? Full of Tarsus. This is Damascus under Assad's evil, oppressive dictatorship. Yep, this is the face of an evil, oppressive dictatorship. Now you can see freedom and democracy. And down below you can see Assad traveling around in his dictatorship. You can see he's really afraid of the people. Before U.S. democracy in Syria, after democracy, much better. And Syria under Assad, Syria under the terrorists. Yep. They call it the civil war. Every last blasted one of the top leaders of ISIS fighting in Syria are not Syrians. It's like a who's who of the world. They've got so many British, Canadian, Saudi Arabian, Danish. I mean, they come from everywhere except Syria. This isn't a civil war. This is an invasion. So this is what poor Syria looks like after all the freedoms. But what most people don't know is 6% of Syria are Christian. 6%, that's a lot for the Middle East. There's a lot of our brothers and sisters in Christ in Syria. Coptic Christians, Assyrian Christians. This isn't the way we worship. But they're willing to die for Christ, so I've got to call them brothers in Christ. Even though this isn't the way we decorate our churches. But I mean, these people have survived under Islam for 1,400 years. And they've got some colourful Christian churches, or they used to. This is thanks to the terrorists funded by NATO, Turkey, Saudi Arabia, and the USA. And the first thing ISIS do is get rid of the church cross and putting up the ISIS flag. And this is what's happening in Syria. Assad, this evil dictator, protects the churches. In fact, in a church, somebody sent me this picture of Christian soldiers in church wearing the Syrian army uniform, because many Christian men are in the Syrian army, because that's all that stands between them and getting beheaded by ISIS. So, sure, they're going to fight for Assad. And Christian children marching with a cross and a picture of this man that is being demonized in the media. And here in the middle of the church, at Easter, you've got the dictator himself, without his bodyguards visible, at least not between him and the people, and his wife, having selfie pictures taken. Where's the fear? This is more like Ian Smith than Robert Mugabe. He's willing to walk it amongst the people. The church leaders of every denomination come to Assad. They see him as their protector, which he is, because without him, they would be under... Yeah. So this is at a church in Syria, and again, the president and people in. There doesn't seem to be fear or hatred. President Bashar al-Assad said, terrorism is like a cancer. When you deal with the consequences rather than the root cause, it'll only spread faster. We told the West it should not support terrorism and give it political cover because it would affect all your countries and your people. They didn't listen to us. Now, both he and his wife studied in England. They were Cambridge graduates. Remember who the original moderate rebel was? Osama bin Laden, funded by CIA. So where are the rebels getting their weapons from? I mean, look at those weapons. They find them lying around, they get them on eBay. Well, the founder of ISIS, al-Bukhari, was captured by the Americans and in prison under George Bush, released the first week that Obama was in power, and he went out and he started ISIS. And the money came from the Ambassador Stevens, the same one who got wiped out in Benghazi attack in 2013. That same man gave them the first $500 million, which came from Qatar, another great American ally. And so Qatar provided the first $500 million. So this Stevens, who we feel sorry for, I mean, nobody deserves to die like that, but he is killed by his people, the ones he is funding, and it's like the Frankenstein he helped to set up. And so under Obama, ISIS was started. ISIS. ISIS beheads people. Who else beheads people? The Wahhabians, Saudi Arabians. Saudi Arabia is the beheading capital of the world. They behead hundreds of people every year. ISIS and Saudi Arabia are the only beheading groups that I know of in the world. I mean, who else does it? Since the French stopped guillotining people in 1972, it's Saudi Arabia is like the only ones to do it. So Saudi Arabia owns ISIS, and Saudi Arabia's most favored nation status with the United States. Here's an American citizen journalist in Syria exposed that the Turkish government was aiding ISIS. She did it on live TV, and 2 days later she was killed in a car accident. But the US government under Obama did not investigate her death. There's no picture able to be taken, but this is how survivors described what happens with ISIS coming into a village. In many cases, Christian villages in Syria. Cause and effect. Why do you have Muslims from Syria fleeing all over Europe? Cause and effect. You bomb the hell out of them. You destroy most of their homes. Yes, people are going to flee. And some of them are coming to Europe. And of course, amongst them would be ISIS terrorists as well. Cause and effect. The West has spent 10 years fighting terrorism. It's killed millions doing so. And now they're supporting the same terrorists in Syria. Does this make sense? And it's true. ISIS, Al-Qaeda and Al-Nusra are being supported by NATO, Saudi Arabia, Turkey, and the United States now. Israel. They're the same people who bombed, yes, ISIS guys when they need medical help. They end up in Israeli hospitals, and they've never attacked an Israeli target yet.
People can't understand how Israel and Saudi Arabia could be allies, but they are.
It doesn't make sense in some ways, but the facts are there. David Steele, formerly US Marine Corps, and of CIA, testified, most terrorists of false flag terrorists, or are created by our own security force. Now, I don't want to believe this. I'm just giving the quote. I can believe some of them, but most... Anyway, I'll just give the quote. In the United States, every single terrorist incident we have had has been a false flag or has been an informant pushed on by the FBI. In fact, we now have citizens taking out restraining orders against FBI informants that are trying to incite terrorism. We've become a lunatic asylum. So this is said by David Steele, formerly US Marine Corps and CIA operative. Have you heard of Operation Northwoods? Operation Northwoods has now been declassified. It's a false flag plan originating within the CIA to organize acts of terrorism, including hijacking, shooting down of commercial planes, attacks on own military and US Navy, bombing civilians in American cities, in order to implicate the Cuban government, in order to justify the actions they want to take. Now, this was presented to President John F. Kennedy, and he refused it. He threw it out. It wasn't long after he was killed himself. But anyway, Operation Northwoods, as it says here, JFK rejected the plan. This was declassified in 1997. This is evidence that there are governments willing to consider those things. British Foreign Secretary Robin Cook declared, "The truth is there is no Islamic army or terrorist army called Al-Qaeda, and any informed intelligence officer knows this. But there is a propaganda campaign to make the public believe in the presence of an intensified entity representing the devil, only in order to drive TV watchers to accept a unified international leadership for a war against terrorism, and the country behind this propaganda is the United States." And of course, it did start in the days of George Bush and it intensified under Obama. Terrorism has replaced communism as the rationale for the militarization of America, for military adventures abroad, and for the suppression of civil liberties at home. It serves the same purpose, serving to create hysteria. And honestly, you've got to travel to America to believe it. The hysteria. The media cycle, it's never ending. There's always some, and you know, this and that, and it's like 24/7. And if you ever watch CNN or BBC or ITV, it's just like, you just can't believe. They're endlessly whipping the people up to accept why they're losing all their freedoms. And this is distraction, distraction. Of course, in our country, it's a different type of distraction. We're dealing with a criminal undertaking at a global level, and there's an ongoing war led by the United States. It may be carried out by a number of proxy countries which are obeying orders from Washington. The global war on terrorism is a U.S. undertaking, which is fake. It's based on a fake premise. It tells us that some America and the Western world are going after a fictitious enemy, the Islamic State, when in fact, the Islamic State is fully supported and financed by Western military alliance and America's allies in the Persian Gulf. They say these Muslims are terrorists, but it just so happens that these terrorists are made in America. The global war on terrorism is a fabrication, a big lie, and a crime against humanity. And this is said by Dr. Michael Chosodowski, University of Ottawa's Professor Emeritus of Economics, at a speech that he gave at the International Conference of the New World Order. And you can Google that and listen to it if you want his whole speech, which is very out of the box, very strange, very different. But unfortunately, there's a lot of facts to back up what he's saying. If you follow the money, you can see that people with the most to gain from these attacks occupied the key military and civilian positions, were instrumental in the covering up of the crimes. How many secretaries of state in the United States have massive oil investments? It's just Condoleezza Rice. Do you know that there's a Gulf Chevron ship named the Condoleezza Rice? She was the secretary of state, you know, and you've got massive involvement of these people in the oil companies and so on. It's chronic. Follow the money. Democracy is the means by which those who adore authority and crave the security of servitude can use their superior numbers to enslave those who wish to be free. It's, people love their chains. How many of you have seen the film Gaslight? Ingrid Bergman, 1950s. It gave the term to the dictionary. Gaslighting is a form of psychological abuse used by narcissists in order to instill in their victims an extreme sense of anxiety and confusion. But a point comes where they can no longer trust their own memory, judgment, or perception. Gaslighting uses brainwashing, interrogation, and torture. It's psychological warfare. There's another term to describe South Africans, especially South African whites. The Stockholm Syndrome. Stockholm Syndrome is when a kidnapped victim begins to identify with the person who's got their life in their hands and attributes to them good intentions and basically identifies with them and might even fight against their liberators to try and free them from the kidnappers because and defend the kidnappers in argument. It's a unique psychological syndrome that's been known and named now as the Stockholm Syndrome. A lot of people in South Africa like the ones, oh, Uncle Nelson, oh, Winnie Mandela, Mother of the Nation, yeah, all the Stockholm Syndrome. So it's pretty bad. When the federal government talks about protecting children from crazy people with guns, remember, they think surrounding the children, setting them on fire is an acceptable option. We're talking about Waco, Texas. Now, I'm by no means finished, but I think it's taken longer than I expected. It must open for questions. But remember, a government big enough to give you everything you want is strong enough to take away everything you have. Thomas Jefferson. Any questions or comments?
Just while you were presenting there, I managed to jot down a few incidents that came out of the that you mentioned through your... If you think of, you mentioned the RB of Beer, it's the same thing with Jan Smuts and the Osabarbaranta.
Yes.
Robin Daybra.
Boy, that was a... That was
Sharpe in the 1960s, that was a false flag attack. Yes. The CIA-inspired false flag attack as well. I mean, if you go and investigate Sharpe, I mean, it was completely staged. It was a staged event. They stormed a police station. Inexperienced police officers opened fire on them. There was no political agenda. It was a dreadful staged event. That's a
and the people staged it didn't care about the victims on either side.
I mean, we had recently the current president of South Africa, Cyril Ramaphosa, was involved with another issue in 1992.
Yes.
Ronnie Cashels basically got the crowd, coerced the crowd to go into the Ciskei Defence Forces firing line, and they were shot. Yeah. And all the cameras were there, and it was a great propaganda piece.
Have you seen?
And that basically, in 1992, there were a lot of things going on in South Africa at the time, and that basically got the international media.
Yes.
To lambaste the sun, because they thought it was they didn't know it was Ciskei Defence Force.
Independence, yeah.
It was independent Bantustans, and not that they automatically think South Africa, ANC, shooting, black, white, bad, done,
yeah. Deal. Meanwhile, just framed, was black, meanwhile, black soldiers defending their country from a communist invasion.
Correct.
Have you seen the video footage, though?
Yeah, I've seen the video.
The moment it happens, look at Ronnie Cashel's face.
Yeah.
Ronnie Cashel's face opens in a big beam. So a whole lot of his people have just got shot, and Ronnie Cashels looks like the happiest man on earth, like he's won the lottery. It's bizarre.
Remember, I think it was before, just after Donald Trump's elections in the States, there was this guy that came out of nowhere as a right-wing extremist called Richard Spencer.
I don't remember that.
I think even a week after, a week after he won the election, there's all of a sudden this media conference where I think Richard Spencer's got this organization called National Alliance.
Okay,
and
this
guy's basically, he gets up onto a stage and he says, hail Trump, hail up. And everybody gets up and Nazi salutes and there's cameras and everything there. And it's really blown out of proportion. And he was also member in the States as well with this recent, what was that, where they marched to defend the Confederate statues in that park.
Oh,
that's the guy, Richard Spencer.
Yes, he is a total leftist.
He's a complete,
and suddenly he becomes a right winger.
Correct. Yeah,
to set up people.
That's the same guy.
Okay.
Richard Spencer.
Boy, so he must have false flag written under him.
The poisoning of that Russian defector agent in the UK.
Yes.
There's just so many. If you really just think about it, they're blatantly in front of you.
In fact, we should start trying to make a list of it because there are a lot of others. This is just skimming the surface, literally.
I mean, some people even think, you mentioned Ian Smith and that sort of thing, although Ian Smith was his own man, he was coerced into, he was trapped into declaring UDI, which was then kind of politically gave, it was like a trap.
He was trapped.
He was trapped. He was forced to do it, but they forced him to do it, and then it gave them the fight against him legitimacy.
I mean, what he did was, he was being principled, but they were playing a devious game that he didn't understand.
He didn't understand.
And I mean, he was dealing with a top-class KGB guy and Harold Wilson. Some people thought Harold Wilson was stupid, but it turns out he wasn't stupid. He was clever, but he was on the wrong side.
And there's so many. Think of it in Brexit, that stabbing of that female MP just before the, I think a few days before the election.
Oh, yes. Yes. That didn't make any sense.
The guy gets, and in the media it says, the guy who murdered her shouted Britain first, and just before the referendum.
I do remember that. That could have swayed it.
I can't remember her name.
It was... There's people who do this, and you think, how can he be so stupid? But if he's on the other side, he's not being stupid.
No, there's just a ridiculous amount. I'm just thinking off my head. There's probably dozens more.
What's about Morgan Tsvangirai?
Well, you know, now there's
either sellout or...
Well, he either... Yes, because basically you had this opposition, and it looks like the opposition was either hijacked or bought out or intimidated or outmaneuvered. But Morgan Tsvangirai, when he won the election in 2008, he accepted second place. Like, he just won the race and, okay, you can take the gold medal, I'll take the silver, and I'll stand on the number two spot. It didn't make sense. And, of course, after 5 years, after he brought in more investment in the country, they kick him out and go back to the same nonsense. So Morgan Tsvangirai was used, outmaneuvered. He's either stupid or... He was bought out and on the other side already. That'll come out one of these days. We'll work it out. You know that Ian Smith only discovered when the book came out, Serving Secretly, by Ken Flower. Ken Flower is the head of Rhodesian CIO, Central Intelligence Organization, Rhodesia's secret police. And that Ken Flower was working for the British all along, that he was betraying them, and he always wondered how it's so often, like, Rhodesia would go out to take out Joshua Nkomo after the shooting down of the Viscounts, and Joshua Nkomo wasn't there. They'd have this assassination plan for Robert Mugabe, and he didn't turn up. And there was all sorts of things that would get blocked, and it turned out in the end, well, the head of Rhodesian CIO was actually working for British MI6 and was betraying us the whole way. So, Ian Smith... one criticism I could give him is he is too trusting. He was, in fact, I said to him on radio, were you not too much of a gentleman? Because you were dealing with backstabbing, duplicitous, treacherous foreign office of Britain. Why didn't you just take independence on their terms? And then once you had independence, have a referendum and do what you thought was best for the country. And he pulled himself up to the full height and he's a tall man. He said, oh no, we couldn't have done that. That wouldn't have been honest. I mean, he looked at me in absolute shock, like I slapped it through a face. We couldn't build Rhodesia on a lie. What kind of example would that be to the Africans? Now, that's the kind of person Ian Smith was, a gentleman. He's dealing with backstabbing scum. You can't fight clean when you're dealing with people like that. And so, dealing with the British Foreign Office or the American State Department, the KGB or any of these characters, you're dealing with people who, if they pat you on the back, they're just feeling for a soft spot to put them out. You cannot trust them. I mean, I must say, as years have gone on, when I started out, things were pretty simple. We were the good guys and they were the bad guys. But as time goes on, to find out how many treacherous people, I mean, that our own president, I use the inverted commas of F.W. de Klerk, would betray us like that. Be such a false for us. I never thought the National Party could betray us. It didn't cross my mind at the time. I thought, you know, they were on our side. It didn't seem possible that you could have people who entrusted with leading the country that could just sell you out. But the idea that one of your generals could send you out there to betray you, or that you could, you know, plan a terrorist attack on our own people. That's the sort of thing.
Ruthless people.
Basically, when you get... When I started to look at this false flag thing, I knew there were some bad things because General Parton alerts me to Oklahoma and TWA 800 and so on. But it just boggles the brain. There's so much false flags, which means so much of what we've got in the news, so much of what we've got in our school textbooks, and so much of what we've got in the films are false. They've accepted the narrative, and we can't allow that in the future. We need journalists to kind of give the real story, the full story, and do investigative journalism, not accept official versions. And that's important in history books. It's important in everything. We cannot allow the lies to keep being perpetuated because lies bring bondage. Truth sets free. So, any other comments? Observations? As you know, I even had more there, but I realized we're out of time. But this, it's just, it, when you get, in some of these, it's like, what do you call it? It's like a hornet's nest. You think you're opening up and you're going to get a hornet or two and say, there's a lot of them. But it's, we could do it just on a false flag in South Africa.
Yeah, there have been so many that I can just think of my head now, just thought of it all.
Okay, so if we could all do a bit of research and dig up a few more things, because obviously this is just a start, but false flags. It's,
I mean, things like Sharpeville and all of that is still being taught in schools.
The same as Soweto. I mean, the thing is, I mean, the way they tell the story about the Soweto riots is that the kids were sitting behind their desks and they got upset about learning in Afrikaans. They ran into the street and got shot by the,
by the white police.
Yeah, yeah.
No black policemen.
No, most of the police force was even black back then.
Yeah, but in the movies, you don't want to confuse people.
Yeah,
you don't
want to confuse
people. Yeah.
Oh, the worst drought in 126 years. And we've had less rain in 7 years ago. And looking through, but this business, you know, it was 100 years and it's 126 years. Well, it's a lie. Now, it's the worst water restrictions in this city system, but it's not the worst drought. Yeah, they're lying even on that. But even when, you know, the more rain you get, the worse the restrictions get, and the emptier the dams get. last year, it was about this time, we won level three. I think we're going to level 3B. And I think we reached, was it May before we got our first rains? So we won up to level 3B before the rains came in May, right? And after it was level 4, level 5, level 6, level 6B. And, you know, the more rain came, the worse the restrictions got. This is, well, Grant Haskin, who's an ACDP councillor and city councillor, he says, this is about politics. This isn't about water or rain. And I think he's dead right. Yeah, the water and the rain is an insignificant part of it. The main part of it is politics. Honestly, I think they're
politicizing water.
Yeah. have you heard that now I've got water police? They've launched the water police.
So why don't you just call them the water stars anymore, actually?
I like it. I think we'll use that term. Trouble is, most people don't know what a Stasi is, but what a KGB? Like you're speaking about the KGB. Any other comments? Okay, so what have you got for us?
There are 5 copies there of A Noble Lie. I just checked it again now. There's a problem with the audio. The sound quality isn't as good. I'm going to try and get a better quality copy.
Let's buy the better copy. Okay, we'll make 10 available next week. If each household here could try and see A Noble Lie and show it to others, lend it to others, because this is one, just, it's the best expose of a false flag I've ever seen. And as General Parton, our board member, was heavily involved in this, in exposing this, I should say.
Yeah.
I think it's so important, because once you've seen that, you will never trust the US government again. I mean, and it has Janet Reno and Bill Clinton. It's got all the worst culprits out there. I mean, these people are the worst of the worst. And you think how many hundreds of people died there, including 15 children?
Yeah, there was a crash or something. Yeah.
But funny enough, not one FBI or ATF agent's children were there that day. Just, I mean, like, total coincidence. But these sort of things happen. But what kind of people do that? And, and I don't know if you remember, most of you probably can't remember because 1995 is a long time ago and before some of you were born. But I remember Bill Clinton came on TV straight after this attack and he blamed James Dobson and his right-wing fundamentalist focus on the family and these homeschoolers.
Yeah, it was. Yeah.
The homeschoolers and James Dobson folks. I mean, we're responsible for this terrorist attack. And at the time I was thinking, where did he get this from? But he orchestrated it so that he could clamp down on those people. I mean, Bill Clinton
and
is
there was also a lot of
evil.
Movies made about domestic terrorism in the States in the late 90s as well. A lot of movies were made as well. There was a movie made replicating this thing. I can't remember the name of it.
Something, the package?
No. It was called The Street.
Okay.
Arlington Way.
Okay. I didn't see that.
It's with, it's got, I can't remember the actors' names. I know their faces, but a similar sort of replication of this.
Oh, the other thing that's just so funny, if you could say funny about this, is this bomb is meant to be a truck bomb, fertilizer bomb in a rental truck. The first thing Bill Clinton wants done as a result is clamp down on handguns. Because of this bombing, we need to have this legislation, which just happened to all be ready, or several thousand pages, but to pass it, and it got Congress just passed us to restrict on handguns and background checks and this and that. No handgun was used in this bombing, but nothing but fertilizer or trucks or chemicals or trailers, which was actually involved. I mean, the Gulf Senate had nothing to do with it. But that he would, and he specifically mentioned James Dobson's radio program spewing hate and creating this impression where people don't trust the government. And think, gee, why would you not trust your government? And you incinerate kids in Waco, shoot a nursing mother at Randy Weaver's wife up at Ruby Ridge. FBI agents went there. This chap was living in the wilderness in the forest, minding his own business because he didn't trust the government. I mean, why would he be so neurotic? They came along, shot his dog and shot his nursing wife through the head with a sniper shot. And when he was taken to trial, the jury set him free, of course. But I mean, why would he not trust the government? He's obviously a conspiracy theorist.
That's the first. That's the slur against you. You start questioning.
Yes, right. So that's why the film brought out by our friends Curtis Bowers and family is called Agenda. This is not a conspiracy theory. It's an agenda. It's a published agenda, and they've said what their aim is. And all we've got to do is read and pay attention. It's not a theory. It's a published agenda, and they've been. It's telling us all along what they plan to do, and they're going ahead on it. So we need to use this information. So, okay, the viewing homework is the noble lie and show it to others. The lecture notes for what I'm giving tonight is on the table there as well. And Arby's got a track that he's written on the Ultimate Day Zero, which if you've got any ideas on how to improve and so on, you can turn to a track and pass that on to people at Water Points. Because there is an Ultimate Day Zero, Jesus mentioned to the in Luke 16, the day when there won't be even one drop of water in hell. That's the ultimate day zero. And also, Aubrey and Terrence's latest newsletter.